Ladies and gentlemen, good evening and thank you for tuning in to our Thursday night programming of Totally Driven Radio. Heh, but why wouldn't you tune into the greatest show heard all around the world?
Freaking Thursday. That's right. Totally Driven Radio. It's Thursday, which means it's Totally Driven Thursday, and we are taped. We're live. We are alive, but we are taped. That's right. Tonight's a taped episode, and actually we're going to be doing some taped episodes for the rest of the summer. We're taking the rest of the summer off from our live shows, although I might pop in a live TDR Rock show at some point this month, so stay tuned for announcements for that. But on tonight's show, I got a couple interviews to play for you. I did these interviews last week, myself and Nick, and we're doing a couple actors here. We got Leon Russom, who is in a new movie called The Midnighters. And you might remember him. He was in The Big Lebowski as the sheriff. He was in the classic TV show Prison Break, which actually came back a couple years ago, but he was in the original form of Prison Break. And he's done a whole shit ton of other things in his career. But really, really cool movie. It's available now on video on demand at all major outlets. Just go look it up. The Midnighters, it's called. It's a cool movie. So I got to talk to Leon about that and other things in his career. So check that interview out. And that one we're going to do second. And we're going to kick off the show with an interview with Mr. Colin Cunningham, which Colin, you might know from the TV show Preacher, or Blood Drive, which was on Sci-Fi Channel last year, or the classic Stargate SG-1. They're another one who's done so much stuff in his career. Those are some of the most recent or most popular things you might know him from. But Nick joined me on this one, and we had a really fun time talking to Colin. Colin's a fun dude and interesting dude. So, you know, without further ado, let's get right into it. Here he is, Mr. Colin Cunningham. All right, Nick, you there? And Colin's there.
I'm here.
He's here. You know what? Here's something real scary for you. I literally was just watching the movie and finished watching the movie, and I saw the very end, and I had freaking chills of anger going up my spine.
Well, that's good. Oh. We did our job.
Oh, crap. You got me all twisted up now. So for everybody listening, this is Colin Cunningham, actor extraordinaire. My co-host Nick is on the line as well. He's a big fan from shows you've done like Blood Drive and Preacher, so he wants to talk to you about that stuff.
Cool.
But the movie you're promoting, Little Pink House, holy crap. What a story.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's interesting. Like, as an actor, look, I mean, we're blessed, or I'm blessed anyway, to do a bunch of different kinds of things. And often my bread and butter is, you know, you go into a room that's all green and you fire a laser beam at an alien, or it's a cop show, or it's a procedural or something. But when Little Pink House, Courtney Ballacher, when she called me up and said, look, I've got the rights to this book, Little Pink House, which is essentially Suzette Kilo's story of how she tried to keep her home. There's a thing called eminent domain, which basically says that if the government wants your home, they can take it. And she took this all the way to the Supreme Court because it was used in a manner or in a way that wasn't necessary. It wasn't legal. It's, you know, usually eminent domain is if there's a freeway that needs to come through, or we have to build a hospital here, or something important. But instead, this was a private corporation, in this case, Pfizer, wanting to make Viagra, and they were just going to go ahead and rip down the entire neighborhood to put up. It wasn't so much Pfizer, the government and the politics, and but it's a true story, and she took it all the way to the Supreme Court. So it was just really nice for me to come on board something that was true. You know, it wasn't about right. saving the universe or the galaxy. It was about trying to save somebody's house. And to tell the story of what happened to this one woman and everyone surrounding her and trying to fight this David versus, you know, Goliath story. So I was quite proud to be a part of it.
Yeah, I mean, like, as I was first starting to watch it, I'm just like, wow, like, this is just such a scary situation and sickening at the same time. And then, like, I don't want to give the ending away for people, but holy crap, like... Wow, it makes it even more
yeah difficult. No, it absolutely. And the great thing for me, which was not, it's such so rare to experience this, but I got to actually meet Suzette Kilo. I got to meet the woman behind the story, and I got to meet a lot of the legal team that supported her and that went to bat for her for years. So it's just really, really cool, you know, to meet real life heroes like that. You know, it's not necessarily a caped crusader. Instead, it was this this woman who worked as an EMT and just you know, had this home of hers, this little home, which was her dream home, and she painted it pink, and the neighborhood in which she lived in, and then they came to tear it down. So it's just a great story. It's a story that needed to be told, and I think Courtney Ballack, our director, just did a phenomenal job with it. So it's nice that to do something you feel good about, you know, that isn't so much
sure.
about paying your rent or trying to sell, you know, paper towels. You know, instead it's like, hey, these are good stories, and wrap it all up in a damn good movie that'll entertain you and give you a little something to think about for 90 minutes, you know, while being entertained. It's pretty cool.
Absolutely. Now, it's funny, too, because I was thinking, I was wondering, was if you got the chance to meet Suzette or even your character, Billy, or people that were involved in this.
Yeah, no, I got to meet them. Unfortunately, I didn't get to meet the actual Billy Von Winkle, who apparently he's quite the character, man. I mean, there's stuff in there in the movie that is true. He had his own history battling City Hall, and he literally took a couple giant buckets of chicken crap and brought them into City Hall during a meeting and just dumped them there through because they were giving him grief over something, and he ended up making it on Leno. So he got on the Tonight Show. He was kind of famous in his own right before he even met Suzette. So certainly a great band, a great cast of characters that came together to fight some of these battles and took it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I was going to see if you got any tips from him on how you were dumpster diving for paperwork. it's too funny. Too freaking funny. So the one scene that was really that I thought heart-wrenching was as they demolished the house next door to the pink house, and Suzette's out there on her front little porch sweeping all the debris off. I was just like, oh, man. Like that was just like the scene in the movie that really got to me.
Yeah, no, I'm not, again, I gotta hand it to the director, to Courtney. It's just trying to find just some simple things, and sometimes you'll do strange things when confronted with you know, such heavy truth and reality. But yeah, they went and tore down this home next to hers, and of course all the dust is all over the place, and you don't know what to do, and you're in kind of a state of shock. And the scene that you're referring to is she is kind of sweeping off some of the dust and the debris to try and clean her own home, and you just don't know what to do. And
right.
you know, and it, but again, that's also what makes the film just so sweet and endearing and also very real and poignant. It's because it's not like a big giant hole opens up in the universe and everybody gets sucked through it. Instead, it's a woman who's at the end of a rope just trying to achieve some measure of normalcy or normal. Yeah, just normality, you know, because the world's falling apart. You're losing your home. It's literally like crushed, demolished. So
right.
It's wild. It's interesting that these stories still exist. And but again, I got to commend filmmakers for keeping them alive and for telling these stories, because they're still happening, you know.
Now, do you prefer to do like roles like this compared to a role like you did in Blood Drive or with Preacher, like more where you're getting these? Because I was thinking too, like when you get to do those roles, you have to think to yourself on the back end, like, okay, I can probably hook this into some Comic-Con scenes or, you know, appearances in the future and make some, you know, off that whole world. It's like a whole other world going on.
Look, I really have. I've been so unbelievably blessed. I really, really have, because I'm not a character actor. I'm an actor that does characters. And it's hard enough getting a job as an actor, but if you never do the same thing twice, it can be really difficult. You know, and God bless the George Clooney's and the Kevin Costner's out there, because they're bankable and they're awesome and they're great at what they do, and the Henry Fonda's. Whereas I'm not good at that. If I got to show up and look like me and just do me every time, people will tune out really, really, really quick. So instead, you know, I'm just more of the actor. I love the Lon Chaneys and the Peter Sellers and the Alec Guinnesses and the Gary Oldmans. You know, these guys, they change it up, you know, and that's what I love to do. So if anything, it's nice to go from something that's absolutely insane, like Blood Drive, you know, or TC on Preacher. You know, I just shaved the whole top of my head for that to just look like I was just crazed and bald, you know, but keeping all the hair at the sides and the back, you know, and then to just do something, let's say, more straight up, just a straight ahead drama, no bells, no whistles, no, don't light your hair on fire, don't do any backflips, just stand there. And working opposite the incredible, Catherine Keener, and just engage. And there's no
right.
There's no net. There's nothing to save you. There's no laser beams. There's no explosion going to go off in the background. There's no engines eating people. It's just you. And so that can be just such a thrill. Because if anything, it takes you back to the stage, and it's just, that's it. You're it's make or break. If the scene sucks, it's your fault, because there's nothing here to save you. So I like that. It's great.
Speaking of engines eating people, Blood Drive. I know my co-host Nick saw the whole season. I saw a couple episodes, and I just remember saying to him, "Dude, this might be the most twisted show I've ever seen."
Man, I'll tell you, I've heard a lot of people, and they're like, first off, thank you. Secondly, a lot of people are like, damn it, why doesn't Sci-Fi bring it back? Screw those guys for not giving it a second season. And I'm like, let me remind you, they gave it a first season. What network is that insanely awesome to greenlight that show? A post-apocalyptic intercontinental death race with cars that are fueled by human blood. Okay, let's do that. But they did. They bankrolled it, and we went out there, myself and James Rowland and David Straighten, and it was an incredible experience, man, because it had never been done before. I mean, a lot of times it was like, well, what are we, this scene or this location or this, what are we doing here? It's like, I don't know. They'll tell you, this has never been done before. Nobody's ever done a show about engines that eat people. So what do you think we should do? And it was creatively, there was really nothing else to rival it in my career.
So I got to ask before I let Nick start asking away at his questions. We had one of your co-stars on, we actually had her on like 2 years ago, Christina Ochoa. How was it working with her?
Oh, she was great, man. Christina's awesome. Really, really awesome. Such a, and I wasn't familiar with her. I hadn't worked with her before. I mean, she's obviously gorgeous, as we all know, but she's a smart chick, man. That is not some dummy brunette. She's got a bit of brains on her, and she's a good gal. I miss her.
I'll tell you what, I think I saw the one scene with her, and I just was like, holy crap, is that really hard in this scene? I was blown away.
Yeah.
So, Nick, here's Colin. Are you there?
I am here.
Hey, buddy.
Oh, hey, man. So, it's kind of crazy. I mean, you've been in a lot of sort of genre-specific stuff. I mean, I'm looking over the filmography here, and there's a lot of comic book stuff. There's a lot of sort of alien type stuff with the Stargates and Falling Skies, but also like Hell on Wheels and Rush. There's a huge sort of just drama, comedy, sci-fi. Is there one genre that you prefer to be in?
No, because what genre is basically just the wrapping on the box. It's
okay.
What's in the box, you know. I mean, you can say, oh, you know, the first Alien movie. That's a sci-fi movie? That is not a sci-fi movie. I mean, it's not in terms of a genre. That is a full-blown thriller, scare you have to death movie. It just happened to be in outer space, and that's what made it kind of different. But whether it's a Western, whether it's outer space, is it any good? And then it's like, okay, you know, if the story's about people and there's stuff you can relate to, I mean, I've been in pitch meetings, literally in pitch meetings. We've got this script, and it's about the father trying to keep his son or keep his family intact. Second question, are we going to make it a sci-fi show? Is it going to be a Western? Are we going to do a period piece? Is it going to take place in New York on the docks? Or are we going to center it in Beverly Hills? So it's the genre becomes, okay, well, what's popular right now? And it's like, well, science fiction. But the vampire thing's popular, too. Okay, let's make the son a vampire. I mean, and then you start getting really stupid and crazy. But basically, in terms of genre, there's only two genres, you know, good and suck. And I prefer to be on the good side of that, you know?
Absolutely. So it's interesting, though, because, you know, Bay contacted me yesterday. He's like, look, this is who's going to be on the show if you want to call in. And it sort of hit me by surprise because, you know, I was a fan of Falling Skies and I was a fan of Blood Drive and I am a fan of Preacher. I had no idea all three characters were you. Like, Blake and John Hope are so far apart from each other, but they are still sort of that grimy, kind of dirty, you know what I mean? Same as PC, but each one of them was approached so differently and acted so, like, I couldn't, it's amazing that I couldn't tell the difference, you know, that it was the same actor. So, I mean, that's definitely praiseworthy, I think.
Well, it is, and I accept it with gratitude and humility. Look, I appreciate that. All my favorite actors, you know, my favorite actors are the Gary Oldman guys and the Peter Sellers and the Alec Guinnesses and the Lon Chaneys and the guys that disappear. But it makes it, I got to say, it makes it extremely hard sometimes. It's hard enough being an actor and trying to get a job. But for me, it can be harder because I never do the same thing twice and I never know what I'm going to do. So nobody can necessarily hire me thinking, oh, we love Colin because I don't even, you know, the guy, you never know what the hell the guy's going to do. So nobody's going to cast me off of my name. I need to audition for each and every thing. And it's tough because it's never the same kind of thing, you know. It's but I appreciate it because look, there's a lot of luck involved too, but it is great. Look, I and also just me personally, I love to. It's nice to be acknowledged for what you do, but I don't necessarily want to be recognized. I mean, I really don't. I don't need the nice table in the restaurant. I don't want my photo taken. I mean, I want to be able to go and watch you. I want to go to the beach. I want to go to sit in the park, sit on a bench. And I will monitor your ass. I don't want anybody looking at me. So at best, and it is what it is. But sometimes, you know, somebody says, "God, I know you from somewhere." They can't quite place it. That's fine, you know. That's fine, because I'm sure we've all been out with a familiar face, and you can't go out. You can't. It's like, hey, let's go out. It's like, no, I'm not with you. I'm staying in. It's just not fun, you know?
So you don't want people coming up to you to take selfies to put on Instagram?
It's weird. Like, you know what? That stuff in itself is – that part's never bothered me so much. What has bothered – what is weird, I should say, is that you realize that you thought you were alone. You thought you were just eating. You thought you were just reading. You thought you were just doing whatever you were. And then you realize, no, you've been monitored since you walked in here. That's the weird part. It's like you just thought you were – you didn't think anything until somebody pointed you out. Then you realize, oh, my God, you're not anonymous. And it's just weird. All of a sudden you're singled out when you were just sitting there, you know, thinking about your life or whatever. So it's just odd. It's odd. But fortunately, it doesn't happen all that often. It really doesn't, because the stuff I do is so different from one thing to the next. Nobody's ever really quite sure, or they don't know where from. And I'm not a big name. It's great, you know, so I don't want nor need the entourage or any of that kind of stuff. I'm able to kind of go from one gig to the next, do what I absolutely love to do, and then just kind of just disappear back into the bushes again. It's great.
Nick, do you have anything else?
Yeah, well, okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about Falling Skies, because it was kind of a big deal, right? I mean, this is executive produced by Steven Spielberg. It lasted 5 seasons, and kind of like what you're talking about, the characters that you portray and how you're not sort of typecast into one sort of genre or type of villain or anything like that, I thought it was amazing that the show itself was full of actors that sort of have that same sort of thing going on for them. I mean, guys like Will Patton and Doug Jones, of course, I mean, they blend in everywhere. Sometimes you just don't realize they're there, and it was amazing to see it come together, and your arc especially, because you sort of went from, like, badass villain to badass good guy to badass villain again. And it was everybody I know that watched the show loved Pope. You know what I mean? And sometimes that can be hard when you're trying to play a villain.
Well, I'll say, look, there was a lot of great, great stuff in Falling Skies. I mean, the last couple seasons of the show, it kind of lost its way. It did. You know, and I say that with respect and gratitude, but it did. It was like, what the hell is going on? But the first two, three years, like, it was really trying to do something. And it may not have always been successful, but it was trying, and it was honest in its approach. But I think we went through, in 5 years, they went through 6, maybe 7 head writers, showrunners, you know, and that's not good. It's not a good thing. So there were, you know, look, it was what it was, and I'm so grateful to have been a part of it, and Noah Wiley to this day is one of the most generous professional actor human beings I've ever met. He really did. The bar was so unbelievably high with him. He taught me a lot. He taught me, in addition to just his acting, which I always thought was superb, but what, because he was also one of the producers on the show, and what he had to personally navigate, and with all the stuff that nobody hears about, and he was able to still show up on set and never once make you feel, he just kept it all separate, and he was still there to give you 1,000%, and so generous with his time and with the lens. And anyway, I tip my hat to that guy, and Greg Beeman was just one of the best producer directors I've ever worked with in my life. And of course, to have Spielberg on a resume is awesome, and it was a great, great experience, you know. And if anything, I mean, it's nice to be able to go from such a big show with a big budget, and then to do a movie with such heart, like Little Pink House, you know, because right. It was Courtney Ballacher when she called me and says, look, I got the rights to this book, this little book called Little Pink House, which was the Suzette Kilo story, which is a true story about a woman, an eminent domain, and the government wanting to take away her home to do nothing more than prop up a big giant corporation that didn't even go. Anyway, you got to see the movie. I can't tell you about it. You got to see the flick. But it's great. I've been really, really blessed that I can be battling and saving the universe in on one show and helping a woman try and save her damn house in another. So I've been quite blessed for sure.
Now, where can everybody see Little Pink House?
Well, now I'm hoping that might be information that you guys can share to your listeners, because I'm not entirely sure. I know that it's a pay per or a subscription service, or it's just out now. You can dial up and use your thumb and you know, launch a rocket, or watch Little Pink House. You can do both. Kind of cool.
You can fly a drone, or you can watch Little Pink House. I say
Little Pink House on a drone. The drone can just fly from outside your window, and you can just watch it right there.
And we're not saying to fly a drone around a pink house that you find, but to actually watch the movie, Little Pink House.
Yeah, you order it, and it's just footage of someone flying around a little pink house.
Right. Colin, thanks for doing this, man. Thanks for calling in. We were about to reschedule, and I was able to squeeze it in, so we got it done. If I could just get you to cut an ID before I let you go.
Formally, guys, though, but thank you so much for supporting the film and for supporting me and just you being a couple of wackos that you are. Thank you.
We try. Yeah, so if you just this is Colin Cunningham, and you're listening to Totally Driven Radio.
Got it. This is Colin Cunningham, and you are – do it now?
Yep, go for it.
You guys got it? Oh, sorry, I thought I heard some feedback. here we go. 3, 2. This is Colin Cunningham, and you are listening to Totally Driven Radio.
Awesome.
That's awesome.
Colin, thanks so much, man, and we'll get all that info out there
guys.
For everything. Take
Very
care.
Much. Thank you, guys. Talk soon. Bye.
All right, bye.
And, guys, if you want to check out Little Pink House for yourself, you can check it out on Google Play, on YouTube, and you can go to littlepinkhousemovie.com.
Perfect.
He's in at 9.
Yeah.
He's in at 9.
He's usually here between 8 and 9.
All right, 9:05.
Hey, sorry about that.
No problem. I was just saying that if anybody wanted to listen to or watch the movie, they could go to YouTube and you can buy it there. You can buy it on Google Play. You can go to littlepinkhousemovie.com or you can go to facebook.com/littlepinkhouse, and it's pretty much available all over, right?
I'll tell you, I literally just got done watching it, and I flipped over and saw you guys are on there. The final scene is so, I had chills going up my spine of anger. I really did, honestly. So, I mean, it's the fact that it's a true story, and it's a good movie. It really is.
You know, it's crazy because the whole sort of idea behind eminent domain is something that has sort of captured the minds of Americans for a really long time. You know what I mean? If you go back to, like, some of the Westerns and stuff like that, there's always some sort of evil railroad company or evil chemical company, you know what I mean, coming in and trying
right.
to take people's lands. So I think it is sort of a topic that always resonates with people because, you know, when you own something, you're constantly afraid somebody's going to take it away from you, you know?
Dude, I tell you what, like, I honestly never even, like, thought of that. Like, you hear about it, yeah, like, on the news
sure.
or TV shows or stuff like that, but I never honestly really thought about it until watching this movie. And it's really, like, eye-opening to see what happened and what they went through, and holy crap.
Now, Colin here, dude, like, he's had, like, he was being all modest and stuff, you know what I mean? But I'm thinking, like, this dude was in the Crow series, Elektra, Preacher, Smallville, you know what I mean? Like, those are just the comic book ones. Like, we're not even talking about, like, the X-Files and all three Stargates and, you know what I mean? Like, this guy's the Twilight Zone, the Dead Zone. Like, lots of really awesome genre stuff. You know what I mean? Like, And it's just crazy how he's almost unrecognizable from one show to the other. It honestly is so impressive.
Dude, when you were saying that, I was kind of like shocked that you didn't realize that it was the same guy.
No, because so in Falling Skies, he's like this tough, like rugged biker type. But then when you go to like Blood Drive, he was sort of like, he looked like sort of a dirty magician. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he's like the ringleader guy.
Right. So there really was no way to sort of look at them and be like, oh, wow, that's the same guy. And like you said in Preacher, he's like a Louisiana hillbilly with a shaved head that's long on the side. He looked like a Freak Show from Harold and Kumar.
Crap.
So, yeah, I mean, it really is amazing that just, you know what I mean? Like you can go in there and those are always the actors that sort of impress me are the ones that are sort of like, when Bruce Willis is in a movie, you're like, okay, that's Bruce Willis playing whatever. But this
right.
this guy's different. This guy, I mean, you remember the character, not the actor. And I think that it says something about the skill level of acting.
Yeah. That's cool, though. I mean, it's weird to hear somebody say, like, they like not being recognized and noticed and...
Yeah, it's rare these days. Wow, too funny, man.
Wow. That was cool. That was definitely cool. I'm glad you hopped on.
Awesome. Yeah, man, it was fun. It was ridiculously hot in my room, but it's all good. We got thousands of degrees in Arizona right now, but whatever.
Too funny. So, all right, welcome back to Dream Radio. Bay Ragney here. There you go. There he is, Mr. Colin Cunningham, and he's promoting his new movie. It's called Little Pink House. You can go to littlepinkhousemovie.com for more info on that, where you can check it out. It's a really, really, really freaking good movie. It actually kind of pissed me off at the end, and I didn't want to give away the ending, and I still don't want to give away the ending. It's a true story, and you really should check it out. I'm sure it'll ruffle your feathers like it did mine, but it's a great movie. Check it out. So there you go. All right, so let's go on to the second half of the show now, and here he is, legendary actor, Mr. Leon Russom. Leon.
Hello.
Hello, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, and you?
I'm doing good. You know what, too? And actually, as I was going through and researching, I found an old commercial of yours, and now I want to go have a Stroh's beer in your honor.
Oh, my God. I didn't even know they still existed. That was funny. That was a big campaign, and we'd never heard of Stroh's back east. I was in New York at the time. And then the next thing I knew, they blanketed the country, and then they disappeared. I can't get it to California, and I can't remember seeing the last time I saw Stroh's beer.
Yeah, right. Me neither. I saw that and I cracked up though. Just it brought me back to my childhood, seeing all those commercials.
Yeah.
So the new movie. Actually, I it's 2 years old now, The Midnighters. I guess it's hitting on video on demand now?
It started at midnight last night, yeah.
Awesome.
And,
awesome.
And I think it's also out on DVD and Blu-ray today.
Cool.
I don't know. Sure, I haven't called any stores, but that's what I hear.
So this was actually like... the person you worked with on this, Julian Fort, who wrote the story and produced it. You guys actually met in a Starbucks. Is this how I'm figuring it out?
Oh, here, I'll tell you because I think this should have been a movie. because I was in Big Lebowski.
Okay.
When I go into a Starbucks, especially a few years ago. They recognize me, and the next thing I know, I think over the years I've gotten more in free coffee than I have from doing Lebowski. And so when I would come in, people would start conversation. And Julia was quiet, and then all of a sudden he became the one who asked me the most questions. And we began to just have talks about movies. We'd talk about Kubrick for an hour or whatever. And then we began to arrange to meet at closing time. So we would wind up standing out, shivering in the cold, and still discussing movies. And he came to me one day and he said, "I've written a script, and maybe you would like to do it." And he showed me, he gave me the script, and it was a what I call a slasher movie.
Okay.
But it was very well written. And he had a long a character who suddenly had a long speech at the end of the film. And he wanted me to do that. And I said I'd be happy to do it, that it probably wasn't a movie I'd want to see, but I'd be very glad to be in it. And I told him how well I thought he had written it. Then that sort of fell by the wayside. And about 6 months later, he said, "I've written a script for you. Would you read it?" And I said, "Of course." And then we spent about 5 years having a start date and then not doing it in the start date and not doing it in the start date and it not happening. And then finally, he got together enough money to do the shoot. And then came another 5 years of waiting to get through all of post-production, all of which costs money, and then going to the various festivals and finding that he couldn't get a theatrical release, and so he wound up doing a direct-to-video. And so for me, this has been like a 10-year thing. For him, it's been his whole life. And, of course, the odd thing is he works as a security guard at Paramount. And I kept thinking this was such a great human interest story that Paramount themselves would respond. But it never got high enough in their hierarchy for anyone who could make a decision to be able to make a decision about the only thing that only perk he got from Paramount was that we used their parking lot, which is high up in the air, for one of the central scenes. Okay. And we had a meeting, a scene where all the Russians and the heroes meet, and that was shot, oddly enough, in the Paramount paint shop. It had the right feel and it looked right, and so we shot there when no one was working. And those are the only two times that Paramount was involved, even though it seems to me they could have gotten a great deal of publicity of a human interest kind of way if they had sort of twigged what he was up to.
Wow.
But we never got that.
No, I mean, this for 10 years, especially early on, did you think, like, being the fact that it was his first time going through this, like, this is never going to happen, or just maybe, like, just maybe he's just kind of, like you
said,
he
was so determined. He was so determined that I was sure that he was going to do it. I just didn't know if you'd do it in my lifetime.
Right.
I used to make jokes about how this would be released as a posthumous movie. But because I was 72 when we shot it, and I'm now pushing 77.
Oh, wow.
So
okay.
And, of course, since then, I wound up doing a single scene in a movie that was number one this year for 3 weeks running, A Quiet Place.
Yeah, yeah.
And And that was just fortuitously, it just happened to come out a week before on direct video, a week before this one.
So it's good to kind of piggyback off of that as well.
Well, I tried in my interviews for that. I kept mentioning the Midnighters to make sure that they would be aware of it. But we'll see.
So this,
I mean, this is the first day.
Well, this, I mean, it sounds like, too, like this became kind of like a passion project for you.
Well, when I read the script, I just went, my goodness, this is a great gift, because I normally play like the third or fourth guy in a film. And I'm in every scene of this film. I mean,
right.
Virtually every shot. So it was like a great present, you know. So naturally I felt passionate about it and incredibly grateful to Julian for having written it and for all the work he went through to try to get it done.
Right.
My big hope is that there'll be enough video hits and enough streaming and enough videos so that he can make his money back.
Right, right.
I mean, the goal is always for him to be able to make another movie, you know, to establish himself.
Now, being the fact that it was
that, I hope
you,
that worked.
I think
sorry.
It will. I got to watch it earlier. I really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a hard sell, though, because who wants to watch a geriatric do what you can watch a stunning young guy with abs do? You know, it flies in the face of current what most people want to see right now.
Come on. You could have showed off your abs, and it would have sold even more.
I'm sorry? Oh, yeah, right, of course. but yes, it did become a thing of passion, and it became so for all the other actors. Like the fellow who plays my parole officer, we had just done a play together. And
okay.
I called him and asked him if he wanted to be in this film, and he said, where do I park and what do I wear? So almost all of us in some fashion knew each other from before. And we had our pick of all of LA's good actors that are not stars. And so we were able to get people to do things that they are enormously overqualified for, but that they were willing to do because we all knew each other.
Right. Now, being the fact that you were, I mean, this story was written for you, you're the lead, did you feel any pressure that was put upon you to do this?
Well, oddly enough, there's a great relief when a thing's been written for you, because all of a sudden you go, oh, it's time to do, and Julian kept reminding me of it. It's time to be a leading man as opposed to a character, which means that for once in my life, I didn't have to like come up with an accent or what I call professional deformations, which is, you know, where lawyers have certain things in common that you always have to hit if you're going to play a lawyer and things like that. Right. But
right.
This was a piece written. I mean, I could take things in my life and they sort of fit. Like
right.
if you spend 35 years in prison, that's not unlike spending 50 years in Hollywood not being a star. You know, there's so many ways that you could take your own life and use it. And also, we had to work with such speed that I had to know exactly what I wanted to do in each scene. And, of course, one of the things that I discovered right off was if you're the lead in a film, you don't have to carry it. You can give every scene in terms of, if it were a competition, you can give every scene to the actor you're playing with because you're in every scene.
Right.
And it's their moment to shine. And that gives you a great relaxation, a great freedom, because you go, okay, it's in your court now. You're carrying it. And so I had to just be sort of the still center around which everything moved, you know. And that's a great feeling. But every time I would do something character-y, Julian would remind me that this is a leading man. It's an older guy, but he's a leading man.
Right.
He's not a quirky character. And so a good deal of the acting amounts of the playing of this particular part amounted to hiding a lot, because you don't know what's going on in Victor's mind most of the time, except that you know his situation, but
mm-hmm.
you don't know what he's up to, you know. And what appealed to me in it was, aside from the fact that it was a wonderful present to be given to me to play a lead, was the what it's like to be 35 years out of action and come back into this economy.
Right.
And try to figure out how the fuck you're going to survive, you know. And then just when you think that the film's going to be a depressing film about poverty and old age and trying to fit into a society that you have no place in, the sun rises on the scene and it becomes, he has a purpose. Suddenly,
right.
Victor has a reason to live. And then, of course, there's that fly in the ointment of does his son even like him?
Yeah.
Or is he playing a game on him? You know?
Right.
There was a lot of discussion that fortunately I did not participate very much in because I was busy learning lines. But there was a lot of discussion at one point. My son had a wife. And we shot scenes
okay.
with her. And there was a whole feeling that perhaps the two of them were doing a con on me. And I think that somewhere along the line, Julian decided that that wasn't fruitful. But you can see traces of it in the film. You can see how the confrontation at the very end wouldn't work if you didn't have some suspicion that there's something odd going on between the two of them.
Sure.
Does
sure.
it make sense? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so that was fascinating. I think it had more to do with the way Greg played my son than anything I was aware of. And there's something unique in this film that I've never seen before, too, which is that we get towards the very climax of the film, and then you get a rush of very rapid flashbacks that explain to you what they're up to. Usually those kind of things are placed very far in front, you know, just like exposition. Whereas in this
right.
case, it was like, what you don't know is, and I thought that was pretty clever. And I suspect that had as much to do with what happened when they got into the editing room as it did in where they were going to place those flashbacks initially. So one of the things I discovered is that there are so many movies that go into making a single movie. I mean, there's the movie that the writer has in his head. There's what he gets down on paper. There's what you actually shoot.
Right.
And then there's the edit when they go in and a whole story can change during the edit, you know, not
right.
Hopefully not enormously, or else you probably shot the wrong stuff. But it was interesting to see that process at work, to realize that the film gets made like four or five times in the process, and you think you've got this film, but now you go, oh no, if I niche it this way, it changes this way. And that was fascinating, because I kind of knew that, but I'd never seen it from the inception of the idea all the way through to the release, because I usually come in and do 2 weeks on a movie, you know,
right,
instead of 10 years.
Now,
so,
were you involved like a lot of the behind-the-scenes part of it, or were you just more or less, like you said, focused on learning all your lines for the most part?
Well, when we were at work actually shooting, I focused only on just being an actor. But prior to
okay.
that, we had had long discussions into the night, and we had long discussions about casting. So I participated a great deal in the lead up to the film. But then once it was about acting, then I focused only on that.
Oh, that's good. That's good.
And of course, there's this, you know, the negotiation constantly of whether you're going to alter a speech on the day you shoot it, or whether you're going to say it exactly as written, or whether you're going to do both and give the editor those choices. Or, you know, with some very experienced directors, you purposefully don't shoot things that you don't want the editor to see, because a lot of directors really hate the talking heads phenomenon, you know, where
right.
where you just see shoulder up shots of two people talking.
Right.
And so they just won't shoot them. They'll shoot one long master shot that they think does it all. But you have to be a very experienced director with quite a lot of clout to get away with that, because usually there's a boss that's saying, I need this footage because I want to make sure that we've got everything covered. If you're making your own film the way Julian was, you don't have a boss, which is really nice.
Right.
It puts you in the position that the Coens have contrived to stay in all their career, where nobody tells the Coens what to do. You know, you take
now,
them
about,
on. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, how about, like, you personally, like, getting into the mind of Victor, preparing to play that role? Was there any, like, research that you did? Did you talk with any, like, ex-cons who have gotten out of jail to kind of see, like, where their head was? And
Not really. Because when we finally got around to time to shoot, things were happening very quickly. And this is about the situation that he's in when he gets out, you know?
Right.
I talked to some people about, he talks about his problems, just how he keeps continuing to hear things from the prison in one early scene. So I talked to folks about that, about what's the routine. But as far as his central problem of going, what am I going to do with my life
mm-hmm.
when I'm not qualified for anything, I know a lot of people who are in that predicament without ever having been in prison. They just... you know, they reach a certain age and they're not ready to quit, but they don't really know what they're going to do next, you know, and or whether they will survive, because economics have gotten very weird for folks. And after the 2008 crash, there were tons of people who just lost all their retirement money. So,
right.
I was in an orphanage when I was a kid, which is very organized and very isolating. You know, your life, you're told what to do all the time. So I could play with that. But as I've gotten older, I find that I don't really need to do the research if the script is written well. The words will tell me where I am.
Right.
I depend a whole lot on my intuition, because I've lived over 75 years, and I begin to kind of know how I would react if I were in this situation. You know,
right.
It's a kind of it's what actors call a magic if. If you're
okay.
If I were this person, and if I were condemned to say these things that I personally would not say, if I were, what would that make me? And that will get you a whole lot further than a lot of research will sometimes get you. Everything and not be to express it. So I use a more direct route of just going, okay, this is me in this situation. How the hell will I deal with it? You know?
That's interesting. Now, the one thing, too, like, one of the scenes that really, like, stood out, I honestly felt was, like, so powerful, and it wasn't even, there was no lines in the scene, it was just you and your facial expression, and that was the scene when you go to meet with the girl, and you end up going into the bathroom, and you end up just sitting on the toilet, and like, your face, it was just so powerful. And what like was going through your face, and it was just like, wow.
Yeah, well, what I called that scene the death of I was using a highfalutin word and saying the death of an erotic life, but basically it's he's reluctant to go see that girl. Because he doesn't know how he'll behave. And then he gets there, and she is so beautiful, and she is so young, and she's so sweet, that that any involvement with her would just be putting her to use as a receptacle. You know?
Right.
And he just can't do it. And that, of course, throws into question everything to do with his manhood.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's like a really ghastly defeat to sort of go, I will probably never have sex again in my life, you know, which I think is what he's feeling at that moment, is that sex is no longer viable for him. And if a man gets to that point, and I don't know that very many men do, but if a man gets to that point, that's a biggie. That's a big thing to deal with.
Sure.
And so that's what you're seeing when in my face is it's yet another brick wall, like the economics. He's finding that all aspects of his life are sort of defunct. And how do you stay a person and have a life when everything that you based your life on is falling apart?
Right.
So he literally means it, I think, when he goes, you know, I felt better off inside.
Mm-hmm.
Because at least that was a norm that he could be accustomed to. And he's getting 3 square meals a day.
Right,
you know, in prison. So there were a lot of good things, in if you compare them to what was going on in the film. And then, of course, everything changes totally when he has the problem of trying to save Danny.
Yeah.
Because he's not sure he can, and so I think that's what the thing at the end is. At the end, I have no idea where that goes from there. I mean, they have a lot of money, or a lot of gold that they've got to convert into money. And I have no idea. To me, the ending is a great question mark.
One of those mysteries that they left us hanging. So that means there needs to be a Midnighters 2 now.
Well, that would be nice. but I don't know where it would go. I mean, what, sitting on the beach drinking pina coladas? I really don't know. I really
hey,
don't
if they
know.
Can make 9 Fast and the Furiouses, they can make a Midnighters too.
Yeah. But, you know, the biggest problem is solved in it, which is at least he knows that that he can buy, that he can live. He knows he can pay for things now.
Right.
That's another thing that I find, I never really sat down and discussed with people the film because I was so inside it that I never really knew how to talk about it from the outside. But from the outside, there are a number of things that are never questioned, like the young Russian boy that gets killed. It happens very quickly. Danny has a moment of clearly very disturbed by it, and I sort of go, we got to get out of here. And we don't know how that's going to end. Somebody was killed.
Yeah.
I think in the watching of the film, most people just sort of pass by that because we pass by it.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a number of mysteries like that. You know, are Danny and Victor going to be able to actually relate to each other? Or are they just going to split this up and split from each other?
Right.
There are a number of things that are just not answered, you know. But I think that's true of most films where you raise a lot of questions, but you don't answer them all because then it's just more like filling out a form.
Right.
And having something that feels like it's alive.
Right.
I find quite often with independent films that one of the mistakes they make is they try to answer all the questions. And that means they've got to make their script twist and turn in ways that are mechanistic as opposed to having a feel of life.
Right. Very nice.
I think that's why when we see a good one, we get so excited, you know. I mean, first time I saw a John Sayles movie or a Coen Brothers movie or a Wes Anderson movie, and you just go, oh, that's different, you know, because they don't answer all their questions.
You got to just give those little bird crumbs and not give the full meal to everybody.
Right.
Very nice.
Well, I'm glad you saw it. I thought that I would be speaking to someone who hadn't yet seen the film. And
nope.
I thought, oh my, how do I talk about that?
I watched it this morning. This way I was all ready.
Oh, cool.
So I want to thank you. I know you have another interview coming up any minute. So I want to, Leon, thank you for taking time out to do the interview. I really did enjoy the music.
Oh, sure.
And
we'll
get all this out there.
That's usable. I hope you find something in it that you can use.
Absolutely.
All right. I really enjoyed it.
Well,
thank you very much.
Thank you. Take care.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right, welcome back to Nerdy Rocks, Bay Ragney, and there you go, Mr. Leon Russom from The Midnighters. Check the film out. Good flick. Go to themidnightersmovie.com for more info, and you can watch that. You can get it on Blu-ray or DVD, of course, and it's also on Google Play, the iTunes Store, Amazon Prime, Video On Demand. So check it out. Enjoy it. I wouldn't steer you wrong. I really wouldn't. So, all right, so here, Toe Jim Entertainment, Toe Jim Radio. Make sure to like us, love us, follow, subscribe to us. All that fun stuff all over social media, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, as well as you can subscribe to us, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify. Go to Blog Talk Radio, Spreaker, Stitcher, TuneIn, and there might even be more. Just do it. Check us out. Keep up to date with us.
And, yeah, find out what we'll be doing next week. I think we're going to do a best of show next week. So we're going to pull out some of our classic interviews and play them for you. Give you some laughs, some good times, some fun times, some totally driven times. So remember, until next time, stay driven, everybody. See ya.